designed experiment by Karen Stromswald and the neurologists David Kaplan and Nat Alpert, obtained an even more precise picture. It showed one circumscribed part of Broca's area lighting up. So is Broca's area the grammar organ? Not really. Damage to Broca's area alone usually does not produce long-lasting severe aphasia. The surrounding areas and underlying white matter, which connects Broca's brain to other brain regions, must be damaged as well. Sometimes symptoms of Broca's aphasia can be produced by a stroke or Parkinson's disease that damages the basal ganglia, complex neural centers buried inside the frontal lobes that are otherwise needed for skilled movement. The labored speech output of Broca's aphasics may be distinct from the lack of grammar in their speech, and may implicate not Broca's area, but hidden parts of the cortex nearby that tend to be damaged by the same lesions. And, most surprisingly of all, some kinds of grammatical abilities seem to survive damage to Broca's area. When asked to distinguish grammatical from ungrammatical sentences, some Broca's aphasics can detect even subtle violations of the rules of syntax, as in pairs like these. John was finally kissed Louise. John was finally kissed by Louise. I want you, Will, to go to the store now. I want you to go to the store now. Did the old man enjoying the view? Did the old man enjoy the view? Still, aphasics do not detect all ungrammaticalities, nor do all aphasics detect them, so the role of Broca's area in language is maddeningly unclear. Perhaps the area underlies grammatical processing by converting messages in mentalese into grammatical structures and vice versa, in part by communicating via the basal ganglia with the prefrontal lobes, which subserve abstract reasoning and knowledge. Broca's area is also connected by a band of fibers to a second language organ, Wernicke's area. Damage to Wernicke's area produces a very different syndrome of aphasia. Howard Gardner describes his encounter with a Mr. Gorgon. What brings you to the hospital? I asked the 72-year-old retired butcher 4 weeks after his admission to the hospital. Boy, I'm sweating. I'm awful nervous, you know. Once in a while I get caught up. I can't mention the terapoi. A month ago, quite a little. I've done a lot well. I impose a lot, while, on the other hand, you know what I mean. I have to run around, look it over, trebon and all that sort of stuff. I attempted several times to break in, but was unable to do so against this relentlessly steady and rapid outflow. Finally, I put up my hand, rested it on Gorgon's shoulder, and was able to gain a moment's reprieve. Thank you, Mr. Gorgon. I want to ask you a few... Oh, sure, go ahead. Any old think you want. If I could, I would. Oh, I'm taking the word the wrong way to say all of the barbers here. Whenever they stop you, it's going around and around, if you know what I mean. That is, tying and tying for repuser, repuseration. Well, we were trying the best that we could, while another time it was with the beds over there, the same thing. Wernicke's aphasia is in some ways the complement of Broca's. Patients utter fluent streams of more or less grammatical phrases, but their speech makes no sense and is filled with neologisms and word substitutions. Unlike many Broca's patients, Wernicke's patients have consistent difficulty naming objects. They come up with related words or distortions of the sound of the correct one. Table is chair. Elbow is knee. Clip is plick. Butter is tubber. Ceiling is leasing. Ankle is ankly, no mankle, no cankle. Comb is close, saw it, sit it, cut, the comb, the came. Paper is piece of handkerchief, pauper, hand pepper, piece of hand paper. Fork is tonsil, teller, tongue, fung. A striking symptom of Wernicke's aphasia is that the patients show few signs of comprehending the speech around them. In a third kind of aphasia, the connection between Wernicke's area and Broca's is damaged, and these patients are unable to repeat sentences. In a fourth kind, Broca's and Wernicke's and the link between them are intact, but they are an island cut off from the rest of the cortex, and these patients eerily repeat what they hear without understanding it or ever speaking spontaneously. For these reasons, and because Wernicke's area is adjacent to the part of the cortex that processes sound, the area was once thought to underlie language comprehension. But that would not explain why the speech of these patients sounds so psychotic. Wernicke's area seems to have a role in looking upwards and funneling them to other areas, notably Broca's, that assemble or parse them syntactically. Wernicke's aphasia, perhaps, is the product of an intact Broca's area madly churning out phrases without the intended message and intended words that Wernicke's area ordinarily supplies. But to be honest, no one really knows what either Broca's area or Wernicke's area is for. Wernicke's area, together with the angular and supramarginal gyri, sit at the crossroads of three lobes of the brain and hence are ideally suited to integrating streams of information about visual shapes, sounds, bodily sensations from the somatosensory strip and spatial relations from the parietal lobe. It would be a logical place to store links between the sounds of words and the appearance and geometry of what they refer to. Indeed, damage to this general vicinity often causes a syndrome that is called anomia, though a more mnemonic label might be nonamia, which is literally what it means. The neuropsychologist Kathleen Baines describes H.W., a business executive who suffered a stroke in this general area. He is highly intelligent, articulate, and conversationally adept, but finds it virtually impossible to retrieve nouns from his mental dictionary, though he can understand them. Here is how he responded when Baines asked him to describe a picture of a boy falling from a stool as he reaches into a jar on a shelf and hands a cookie to his sister. "First of all, this is falling down, just about, and is going to fall down, and they're both getting something to eat. But the trouble is, this is going to let go, and they're both going to fall down. I can't see well enough, but I believe that either she or will have some food that's not good for you, and she's to get some for her, too, and that you get it there because they shouldn't go up there and get it unless you tell them that they could have it. And so this is falling down, and for sure there's one they're going to have for food, and this didn't come out right. The stuff that's good for, it's not good for you, but you love... smacks lips. And that so they've... See that? I can't see whether it's in there or not. I think she's saying, I want two or three. I want one, I think. I think so. And so she's going to get this one for sure. It's going to fall down there or whatever. She's going to get that one. And there, he's going to get one himself or more. It all depends with this when they fall down. And when it falls down, there's no problem. All they got to do is fix it and go right back up and get some more. H.W. uses noun phrases perfectly, but cannot retrieve the nouns to put inside them. He uses pronouns, gerunds like falling down, and a few generic nouns like food and stuff, referring to particular objects with convoluted circumlocutions. Verbs tend to pose less of a problem for anomics. They are much harder for Broca's aphasics, presumably because verbs are intimately linked to syntax. There are other indications that these regions in the rear of the parasylvian are implicated in storing and retrieving words. When people read perfectly grammatical sentences and come across a word that makes no sense, like, "The boys heard Joe's orange about Africa," electrodes pasted near the back of the skull pick up a change in their EEGs, although, as I have mentioned, it is only a guess that the blips are coming from below the electrodes. When people put their heads in the PET scanner, this general part of the brain lights up when they hear words, and pseudo-words like tweel, and even when they read words on a screen and have to decide whether the words rhyme, a task requiring them to imagine the words' sounds. A very gross anatomy of the language suborgans within the parasylvian might be front of the parasylvian, including Broca's area, grammatical processing, rear of the parasylvian, including Wernicke's and the three-lobe junction, the sounds of words, especially nouns, and some aspects of their meaning. Can we zoom in still closer and locate smaller areas of brain that carry out more circumscribed language tasks? The answer is no and yes. No, there are no smaller patches of brain that one can draw a line around and label as some linguistic module, at least not today. But yes, there must be portions of cortex that carry out circumscribed tasks because brain damage can lead to language deficits that are startlingly specific. It is an intriguing paradox. Here are some examples. Although impairments of what I have been calling the sixth sense, speech perception, can arise from damage to most areas of the left parasylvian, and speech perception causes several parts of the parasylvian to light up in PET studies, there is a specific syndrome called pure word deafness that is exactly what it sounds like. The patients can read and speak, and can recognize environmental sounds like music, slamming doors, and animal cries, but cannot recognize spoken words. Words are as meaningless as if they were from a foreign language. Among patients with problems in grammar, some do not display the halting articulation of Broca's aphasia, but produce fluent, ungrammatical speech. Some aphasics leave out verbs, inflections, and function words. Others use the wrong ones. Some cannot comprehend complicated sentences involving traces, like the man who the woman kissed, trace, hugged the child, but can comprehend complex sentences involving reflexives, like the girl said that the woman washed herself. Other patients do the reverse. There are Italian patients who mangle their language's inflectional suffixes, similar to the ing, s, and ed of English, but are almost flawless with its derivational suffixes, similar to able, ness, and er. The mental thesaurus in particular is sometimes torn into pieces with clean edges. Among anomic patients, those who have trouble using nouns, different patients have problems with different kinds of nouns. Some can use concrete nouns, but not abstract nouns. Some can use abstract nouns, but not concrete nouns. Some can use nouns for non-living things, but have trouble with nouns for living things. Others can use nouns for living things, but have trouble with nouns for non-living things. Some can name animals and vegetables, but not foods, body parts, clothing, vehicles, or furniture. There are patients who have trouble with nouns for anything but animals, patients who cannot name body parts, patients who cannot name objects typically found indoors, patients who cannot name colors, and patients who have trouble with proper names. One patient could not name fruits or vegetables. He could name an abacus and a sphinx, but not an apple or a peach. The psychologist Edgar Zurath, jesting the neurologist's habit of giving a fancy name to every syndrome, has suggested that it be called anomia for bananas or bananomia. Does this mean that the brain has a produce section? No one has found one, nor centers for inflections, traces, phonology, and so on. Pinning brain areas to mental functions has been frustrating. Frequently one finds two patients with lesions in the same general area but with different kinds of impairment, or two patients with the same impairment but lesions in different areas. Sometimes a circumscribed impairment, like the inability to name animals, can be caused by massive lesions, brain-wide degeneration, or a blow to the head. And about 10% of the time, a patient with a lesion in the general vicinity of Wernicke's area can have a Broca-like aphasia, and a patient with lesions near Broca's area can have a Wernicke-like aphasia. Why has it been so hard to draw an atlas of the brain with areas for different parts of language? According to one school of thought, it is because there aren't any. The brain is a meatloaf. Except for sensation and movement, mental processes are patterns of neuronal activity that are widely distributed, hologram style, all over the brain. But the meatloaf theory is hard to reconcile with the amazingly specific deficits of many brain-damaged patients, and it is becoming obsolete in this decade of the brain. Using tools that are getting more sophisticated each month, neurobiologists are charting vast territories that once bore the unhelpful label association cortex in the old textbooks, and are delineating dozens of new regions with their own functions or styles of processing, like visual areas specializing in object shape, spatial layout, color, 3D stereo vision, simple motion, and complex motion. For all we know, the brain might have regions dedicated to processes as specific as noun phrases and metrical trees. Our methods for studying the human brain are still so crude that we would be unable to find them. Perhaps the regions look like little polka dots or blobs or stripes scattered around the general language areas of the brain. They might be irregularly shaped squiggles, like gerrymandered political districts. In different people, the regions might be pulled and stretched into different bulges and folds of the brain. All of these arrangements are found in brain systems we understand better, like the visual system. If so, the enormous bomb craters that we call brain lesions and the blurry snapshots we call PET scans would leave their whereabouts unknown. There is already some evidence that the linguistic brain might be organized in this tortuous way. The neurosurgeon George Ojeman, following up on Penfield's methods, electrically stimulated different sites in conscious exposed brains. He found that stimulating within a site no more than a few millimeters across could disrupt a single function, like repeating or completing a sentence, naming an object, or reading a word. But these dots were scattered over the brain, largely but not exclusively in the parasylvian regions, and were found in different places in different individuals. From the standpoint of what the brain is designed to do, it would not be surprising if language subcenters are idiosyncratically tangled or scattered over the cortex. The brain is a special kind of organ, the organ of computation, and unlike an organ that moves stuff around in the physical world, such as the hip or the heart, the brain does not need its functional parts to have nice cohesive shapes. As long as the connectivity of the neural microcircuitry is preserved, its parts can be put in different places and do the same thing, just as the wires connecting a set of electrical components can be haphazardly stuffed into a cabinet, or the headquarters of a corporation can be located anywhere if it has good communication links to its plants and warehouses. This seems especially true of words. Lesions or electrical stimulation over wide areas of the brain can cause naming difficulties. A word is a bundle of different kinds of information. Perhaps each word is like a hub that can be positioned anywhere in a large region as long as its spokes extend to the parts of the brain storing its sound, its syntax, its logic, and the appearance of the things it stands for. The developing brain may take advantage of the disembodied nature of computation to position language circuits with some degree of flexibility. Say a variety of brain areas have the potential to grow the precise wiring diagrams for language components. An initial bias causes the circuits to be laid down in their typical sites. The alternative sites are then suppressed. But if those first sites get damaged within a certain critical period, the circuits can grow elsewhere. Many neurologists believe that this is why the language centers are located in unexpected places in a significant minority of people. Birth is traumatic, and not just for the familiar psychological reasons. The birth canal squeezes the baby's head like a lemon, and newborns frequently suffer small strokes and other brain insults. Adults with anomalous language areas may be the recovered victims of these primal injuries. Now that MRI machines are common in brain research centers, visiting journalists and philosophers are sometimes given pictures of their brains to take home as a souvenir. Occasionally, the picture will reveal a walnut-sized dent, which, aside from some teasing from friends who say they knew it all along, bespeaks no ill effects. There are other reasons why language functions have been so hard to pin down in the brain. Some kinds of linguistic knowledge might be stored in multiple copies, some of higher quality than others, in several places. Also, by the time stroke victims can be tested systematically, they have often recovered some of their facility with language, in part by compensating with general reasoning abilities. And neurologists are not like electronics technicians who can wiggle a probe into the input or output line of some component to isolate its function. They must tap the whole patient via his or her eyes and ears and mouth and hands, and there are many computational way stations between the stimulus they present and the response they observe. For example, Naming an object involves recognizing it, looking up its entry in the mental dictionary, accessing its pronunciation, articulating it, and perhaps also monitoring the output for errors by listening to it. A naming problem could arise if any of these processes tripped up. There is some hope that we will have better localization of mental processes soon, because more precise brain imaging technologies are rapidly being developed. One example is functional MRI, which can measure, with much more precision than PET, how hard the different parts of the brain are working during different kinds of mental activity. Another is magnetoencephalography, which is like EEG but can pinpoint the part of the brain that an electromagnetic signal is coming from. We will never understand language organs and grammar genes by looking only for postage stamp-sized blobs of brain. The computations underlying mental life are caused by the wiring of the intricate networks that make up the cortex, networks with millions of neurons, each neuron connected to thousands of others, operating in thousandths of a second. What would we see if we could crank up the microscope and peer into the microcircuitry of the language areas? No one knows, but I would like to give you an educated guess. Ironically, this is both the aspect of the language instinct that we know the least about and the aspect that is the most important, because it is there that the actual causes of speaking and understanding lie. I will present you with a dramatization of what grammatical information processing might be like from a neuron's eye view. It is not something that you should take particularly seriously. It is simply a demonstration that the language instinct is compatible in principle with the billiard ball causality of the physical universe, not just mysticism dressed up in a biological metaphor. Neural network modeling is based on a simplified toy neuron. This neuron can do just a few things. It can be active or inactive. When active, it sends a signal down its axon, output wire, to the other cells it is connected to. The connections are called synapses. Synapses can be excitatory or inhibitory and can have various degrees of strength. The neuron at the receiving end adds up any signals coming in from excitatory synapses, subtracts any signals coming in from inhibitory synapses, and if the sum exceeds a threshold, the receiving neuron becomes active itself. A network of these toy neurons, if large enough, can serve as a computer, calculating the answer to any problem that can be specified precisely, just like the page-crawling Turing machine in Chapter 3 that could deduce that Socrates is mortal. That is because toy neurons can be wired together in a few simple ways that turn them into logic gates, devices that can compute the logical relations and, or, and not that underlie deduction. The meaning of the logical relation and is that the statement A and B is true if A is true and if B is true. An AND gate that computes that relation would be one that turns itself on if all of its inputs are on. If we assume that the threshold for our toy neurons is 0.5, then a set of incoming synapses whose weights are each less than 0.5, but that sum to greater than 0.5, say 0.4 and 0.4, will function as an AND gate. The meaning of the logical relation OR is that a statement A or B is true if A is true or if B is true. Thus, an OR gate must turn on if at least one of its inputs is on. To implement it, each synaptic weight must be greater than the neuron's threshold, say 0.6. Finally, the meaning of the logical relation NOT is that a statement NOT A is true if A is false and vice versa. Thus, a NOT gate should turn its output off if its input is on, and vice versa. It is implemented by an inhibitory synapse, shown on the right, whose negative weight is sufficient to turn off an output neuron that is otherwise always on. Here is how a network of neurons might compute a moderately complex grammatical rule. The English inflection s, as in Bill walks, is a suffix that should be applied under the following conditions. When the subject is in the third person and singular, and the action is in the present tense and is done habitually. This is its aspect in lingo. But not if the verb is irregular, like do, have, say, or be. For example, we say Bill is, not Bill bees. A network of neural gates that computes these logical relations and looks like a wiring diagram can be drawn. First, there is a bank of neurons standing for inflectional features. The relevant ones are connected via an AND gate to a neuron that stands for the combination third person, singular number, present tense, and habitual aspect. That neuron excites a neuron corresponding to the S inflection, which in turn excites the neuron corresponding to the phoneme zzz in a bank of neurons that represent the pronunciations of suffixes. If the verb is regular, this is all the computation that is needed for the suffix. The pronunciation of the stem, as specified in the mental dictionary, is simply copied over verbatim to the stem neurons. That is, the form for to hit is just hit plus s. The form for to wug is just wug plus s. For irregular verbs like be, this process must be blocked, or else the neural network would produce the incorrect bees. So this combination neuron also sends a signal to a neuron that stands for the entire irregular form is. If the person whose brain we are modeling is intended to use the verb be, a neuron standing for the verb be is already active, and it, too, sends activation to the is neuron. Because the two inputs to is are connected as an AND gate, both must be on to activate is. That is, if and only if the person is thinking of be and third-person singular present habitual at the same time, the is neuron is activated. The is neuron inhibits the s inflection via a NOT gate formed by an inhibitory synapse, preventing is's or be's, but activates the vowel I and the consonant z in the bank of neurons standing for the stem. I have hand-wired this network, but the connections are specific to English and, in a real brain, would have to have been learned. Continuing our neural network fantasy for a while, try to imagine what this network might look like in a baby. Pretend that each of the pools of neurons is innately there. But wherever an arrow might be drawn, from a single neuron in one pool to a single neuron in another, imagine a suite of arrows from every neuron in one pool to every neuron in another. This corresponds to the child innately expecting there to be, say, suffixes for persons, numbers, tenses, and aspects, as well as possible irregular words for those combinations, but not knowing exactly which combinations, suffixes, or irregulars are found in the particular language. Learning them corresponds to strengthening some of the synapses and letting the others stay invisible. This could work as follows. Imagine that when the infant hears a word with a zzz in its suffix, the zzz neuron in the suffix pool gets activated. And when the infant thinks of third person, singular number, present tense, and habitual aspect, parts of his construal of the event, these four neurons get activated too. If the activation spreads backwards as well as forwards, and if a synapse gets strengthened every time it is activated at the same time that its output neuron is already active, then all the synapses lining the paths between third, singular, present, habitual at one end and zzz at the other end get strengthened. Repeat the experience enough times and the partly specified neonate network gets tuned into the adult one I have pictured. Let's zoom in even closer. What primal solderer laid down the pools of neurons and the innate potential connections among them? This is one of the hottest topics in contemporary neuroscience, and we are beginning to get the glimmerings of how embryonic brains get wired. Not the language areas of humans, of course, but the eyeballs of fruit flies and the thalamuses of ferrets and the visual cortexes of cats and monkeys. Neurons destined for particular cortical areas are born in specific areas along the walls of the ventricles, the fluid-filled cavities at the center of the cerebral hemispheres. They then creep outward toward the skull into their final resting place in the cortex along guy wires formed by the glial cells, the support cells that, together with neurons, constitute the bulk of the brain. The connections between neurons in different regions of the cortex are often laid down when the integrated target area releases some chemical, and the axons growing every which way from the source area sniff out that chemical and follow the direction in which its concentration increases, like plant roots growing toward sources of moisture and fertilizer. The axons also sense the presence of specific molecules on the glial surfaces on which they creep and can steer themselves, like Hansel and Gretel following the trail of breadcrumbs. Once the axons reach the general vicinity of their target, more precise synaptic connections can be formed because the growing axons and the target neurons bear certain molecules on their surfaces that match each other like a lock and key and adhere in place. These initial connections are often quite sloppy, though, with neurons exuberantly sending out axons that grow toward and connect to all kinds of inappropriate targets. The inappropriate ones die off, either because their targets fail to provide some chemical necessary for their survival, or because the connections they form are not used enough once the brain turns on in fetal development. Try to stay with me in this neuromythological quest. We are beginning to approach the grammar genes. The molecules that guide, connect, and preserve neurons are proteins. A protein is specified by a gene, and the gene is a sequence of bases in the DNA string found in a chromosome. A gene is turned on by transcription factors and other regulatory molecules, gadgets that latch on to a sequence of bases somewhere on a DNA molecule and unzip a neighboring stretch, allowing that gene to be transcribed into RNA, which is then translated into protein. Generally, these regulatory factors are themselves proteins, so the process of building an organism is an intricate cascade of DNA making proteins, some of which interact with other DNA to make more proteins, and so on. Small differences in the timing or amount of some protein can have large effects on the organism being built. Thus, a single gene rarely specifies some identifiable part of an organism. Instead, it specifies the release of some protein at specific times in development, an ingredient of an unfathomably complex recipe, usually having some effect in molding a suite of parts that are also affected by many other genes. Brain wiring in particular has a complex relationship to the genes that lay it down. A surface molecule may not be used in a single circuit, but in many circuits, each guided by a specific combination. For example, if there are three proteins, X, Y, and Z, that can sit on a membrane, one axon might glue itself to a surface that has X and Y and not Z, and another might glue itself to a surface that has Y and Z, but not X. Neuroscientists estimate that about 30,000 genes, the majority of the human genome, are used to build the brain and nervous system. And it all begins with a single cell, the fertilized egg. It contains two copies of each chromosome, one from the mother, one from the father. Each parental chromosome was originally assembled in the parents' gonads by randomly splicing together parts of the chromosomes of the two grandparents. We have arrived at a point at which we can define what grammar genes would be. The grammar genes would be stretches of DNA that code for proteins or trigger the transcription of proteins in certain times and places in the brain that guide, attract, or glue neurons into networks that, in combination with the synaptic tuning that takes place during learning, are necessary to compute the solution to some grammatical problem, like choosing an affix or a word. So, do grammar genes really exist? Or is the whole idea just loopy? Can we expect the scenario in the 1990 editorial cartoon by Brian Duffy? A pig, standing upright, asks a farmer, "What's for dinner? Not me, I hope." The farmer says to his companion, "That's the one that received the human gene implant." For any grammar gene that exists in every human being, there is currently no way to verify its existence directly. As in many cases in biology, genes are easiest to identify when they correlate with some difference between individuals, often a difference implicated in some pathology. We certainly know that there is something in the sperm and egg that affects the language abilities of the child that grows out of their union. Stuttering, dyslexia, a difficulty in reading that is often related to a difficulty in mentally snipping syllables into their phonemes, and specific language impairment, SLI, all run in families. This does not prove that they are genetic. Recipes and wealth also run in families. But these three syndromes probably are. In each case, there is no plausible environmental agent that could act on afflicted family members while sparing the normal ones. And the syndromes are far more likely to affect both members of a pair of identical twins who share an environment and all their DNA than both members of a pair of fraternal twins who share an environment and only half of their DNA. For example, identical 4-year-old twins tend to mispronounce the same words more often than fraternal twins. And if a child has specific language impairment, there is an 80% chance that an identical twin will have it too, but only a 35% chance that a fraternal twin will have it. It would be interesting to see whether adopted children resemble their biological family members who share their DNA but not their environments. I am unaware of any adoption study that tests for SLI or dyslexia, but one study has found that a measure of early language ability in the first year of life, a measure that combines vocabulary, vocal imitation, word combinations, jabbering, and word comprehension, was correlated with the general cognitive ability and memory of the birth mother, but not of the adoptive mother or father. The K family, three generations of SLI sufferers, whose members say things like, "Carol is cry in the church," and cannot deduce the plural of wug, is currently one of the most dramatic demonstrations that defects in grammatical abilities might be inherited. The attention-grabbing hypothesis about a single dominant autosomal gene is based on the following Mendelian reasoning. The syndrome is suspected of being genetic because there is no plausible environmental cause that would single out some family members and spare their age mates. In one case, one fraternal twin was affected, the other not. And because the syndrome has struck 53% of the family members, but strikes no more than about 3% of the population at large. In principle, the family could just have been unlucky. After all, they were not randomly selected from the population, but came to the geneticist's attention only because of the high concentration of the syndrome. But it is unlikely. A single gene is thought to be responsible, because if several genes were responsible, each eroding language ability by a bit, there would be several degrees of disability among the family members, depending on how many of the damaging genes they inherited. But the syndrome seems to be all or none. The school system and family members all agree on who does and who does not have the impairment. And in most of Gopnik's tests, the impaired members cluster together at the low end of the scale, while the normal members cluster at the high end, with no overlap. The gene is thought to be autosomal, not on the X chromosome, and dominant because the syndrome struck males and females with equal frequency, and in all cases the spouse of an impaired parent, whether husband or wife, was normal. If the gene were recessive and autosomal, it would be necessary to have two impaired parents to inherit the syndrome. If it were recessive and on the X chromosome, only males would have it. Females would be carriers. And if it were dominant and on the X chromosome, an impaired father would pass it on to all of his daughters and none of his sons, because sons get their X chromosome from their mother and daughters get one from each parent. But one of the daughters of an impaired man was normal. This single gene is not, repeat not, responsible for all the circuitry underlying grammar, contrary to the Associated Press, James Kilpatrick, et al. Remember that a single defective component can bring a complex machine to a halt even when the machine needs many properly functioning parts to work. In fact, it is possible that the normal version of the gene does not build grammar circuitry at all. Maybe the defective version manufactures a protein that gets in the way of some chemical process necessary for laying down the language circuits. Maybe it causes some adjacent area in the brain to overgrow its own territory and spill into the territory ordinarily allotted to language. But the discovery is still quite interesting. Most of the language-impaired family members were average in intelligence, and there are sufferers in other families who are way above average. One boy studied by Gopnik was tops in his math class. So the syndrome shows that there must be some pattern of genetically guided events in the development in the brain, namely the events disrupted in this syndrome, that is specialized for the wiring in of linguistic computation. And these construction sites seem to involve circuitry necessary for the processing of grammar in the mind, not just the articulation of speech sounds by the mouth or the perception of speech sounds by the ear. Though the afflicted family members as children suffered from difficulties in articulating speech and developed language late, most of them outgrew the articulation problems, and their lasting deficits involve grammar. For example, although the impaired family members often leave off the ed and s suffixes, it is not because they cannot hear or say those sounds. They easily discriminate between car and card, and never pronounce nose as no. In other words, they treat a sound differently when it is a permanent part of a word and when it is added to a word by a rule of grammar. Equally interestingly, the impairment does not wipe out any part of grammar completely, nor does it compromise all parts equally. Though the impaired family members had trouble changing the tense of test sentences and applying suffixes in their spontaneous speech, they were not hopeless. They just performed far less accurately than their unimpaired relatives. These probabilistic deficits seemed to be concentrated in morphology and the features it manipulates, like tense, person, and number. Other aspects of grammar were less affected. The impaired members could, for example, detect verb phrase violations in sentences like "the nice girl gives" and "the girl eats a cookie to the boy," and could act out many complex commands. The lack of an exact correspondence between a gene and a single function is exactly what we would expect, knowing how genes work. So, for now, there is suggestive evidence for grammar genes, in the sense of genes whose effects seem most specific to the development of the circuits underlying parts of grammar. The chromosomal locus of the putative gene is completely unknown, as is its effect on the structure of the brain. But blood samples are being drawn from the family for genetic analysis and MRI scans of brains from other individuals with specific language impairment have already been found to lack the asymmetry in the parasylvian areas that we find in linguistically normal brains. Other researchers on language disorders, some excited by Gopnik's claims, others skeptical of them, have begun to screen their patients with careful tests of their grammatical abilities and their family histories. They are seeking to determine how commonly specific language impairment is inherited and how many distinct syndromes of the impairment there might be. You can expect to read about some interesting discoveries about the neurology and genetics of language in the next few years. In modern biology, it is hard to discuss genes without discussing genetic variation. Aside from identical twins, no two people, in fact, no two sexually reproducing organisms, are genetically identical. If this were not true, evolution as we know it could not have happened. If there are language genes, then shouldn't normal people be innately different from one another in their linguistic abilities? Are they? Must I qualify everything I have said about language and its development because no two people have the same language instinct? It is easy to get carried away with the geneticist's discovery that many of our genes are as distinctive as our fingerprints. After all, you can open up any page of Gray's Anatomy and expect to find a depiction of organs and their parts and arrangements that will be true of any normal person. Everyone has a heart with four chambers, a liver, and so on. The biological anthropologist John Tooby and the cognitive psychologist Lida Cosmides have resolved the apparent paradox. Tooby and Cosmides argue that differences between people must be minor quantitative variations, not qualitatively different designs. The reason is sex. Imagine that two people were really built from fundamentally different designs, either physical designs like the structure of the lungs, or neurological designs, like the circuitry underlying some cognitive process. Complex machines require many finely meshing parts, which in turn require many genes to build them. But the chromosomes are randomly snipped, spliced, and shuffled during the formation of sex cells, and then are paired with other chimeras at fertilization. If two people really had different designs, Their offspring would inherit a mishmash of fragments from the genetic blueprints of each. As if the plans for two cars were cut up with scissors and the pieces taped back together without our caring about which scrap originally came from which car. If the cars are of different designs, like a Ferrari and a Jeep, the resulting contraption, if it could be built at all, would certainly not get anywhere. Only if the two designs were extremely similar to begin with could the new pastiche work. That is why the variation that geneticists tell us about is microscopic, differences in the exact sequence of molecules and proteins whose overall shape and function are basically the same, kept within narrow limits of variation by natural selection. That variation is there for a purpose. By shuffling the genes each generation, lineages of organisms can stay one step ahead of the microscopic, rapidly evolving disease parasites that fine-tune themselves to infiltrate the chemical environments of their hosts. But above the germ's eye view, at the macroscopic level of functioning biological machinery visible to an anatomist or psychologist, variation from one individual to another must be quantitative and minor. Thanks to natural selection, all normal people must be qualitatively the same. But this does not mean that individual differences are boring. Genetic variation can open our eyes to the degree of structure and complexity that the genes ordinarily give to the mind. If genes just equipped a mind with a few general information processing devices, like a short-term memory and a correlation detector, some people might be better than others at holding things in memory or learning contingencies, and that would be about it. But if the genes built a mind with many elaborate parts dedicated to particular tasks, the unique genetic hand that is dealt to each person would give rise to an unprecedented profile of innate cognitive quirks. I quote from a recent article in Science. When Oskar Storr and Jack Youf arrived in Minnesota to participate in University of Minnesota psychologist Thomas J. Bouchard Jr.'s study of identical twins reared apart, they were both sporting blue double-breasted epauletted shirts, mustaches, and wire-rimmed glasses. Identical twins separated at birth, the two men, in their late 40s, had met once before 2 decades earlier. Nonetheless, Oscar, raised as a Catholic in Germany, and Jack, reared by his Jewish father in Trinidad, proved to have much in common in their tastes and personalities, including hasty tempers and idiosyncratic senses of humor. Both enjoyed surprising people by sneezing in elevators. And both flushed the toilet both before and after using it, kept rubber bands around their wrists, and dipped buttered toast in their coffee. Many people are skeptical of such anecdotes. Are the parallels just coincidences? The overlap that is inevitable when two biographies are scrutinized in enough detail? Clearly not. Bouchard and his behavior geneticist colleagues D. Lichen, M. Magoo, and A. Telligan are repeatedly astonished by the spooky similarities they discover in their identical twins reared apart, but that never appear in their fraternal twins reared apart. Another pair of identical twins meeting for the first time discovered that they both used Vadimekum toothpaste, Canoe shaving lotion, Vitalis hair tonic, and Lucky Strike cigarettes. After the meeting, they sent each other identical birthday presents that crossed in the mail. One pair of women habitually wore 7 rings. Another pair of men pointed out, correctly, that a wheel bearing in Bouchard's car needed replacing. And quantitative research corroborates the hundreds of anecdotes. Not only are very general traits like IQ, extroversion, and neuroticism partly heritable, but so are specific ones like degree of religious feeling, vocational interests, and opinions about the death penalty, disarmament, and computer music. Could there really be a gene for sneezing in elevators? Presumably not, but there does not have to be. Identical twins share all their genes, not just one of them. So there are 50,000 genes for sneezing in elevators, which are also 50,000 genes for liking blue double-breasted epauletted shirts, using Vitalis hair tonic, wearing 7 rings, and all the rest. The reason is that the relationship between particular genes and particular psychological traits is doubly indirect. First, a single gene does not build a single brain module. The brain is a delicately layered souffle in which each gene product is an ingredient with a complex effect on many properties of many circuits. Second, a single brain module does not produce a single behavioral trait. Most of the traits that capture our attention emerge out of unique combinations of kinks in many different modules. Here is an analogy. Becoming an all-star basketball player requires many physical advantages like height, large hands, excellent aim, good peripheral vision, lots of fast-twitch muscle tissue, efficient lungs, and springy tendons. Though these traits are probably genetic to a large degree, there does not have to be a basketball gene. Those men for whom the genetic slot machine stopped at three cherries play in the NBA, while the more numerous 7-foot klutzes and 5-foot sharpshooters go into some other line of work. No doubt the same is true of any interesting behavioral trait like sneezing in elevators, which is no odder than an aptitude for shooting a ball through a hoop with someone's hand in your face. Perhaps the sneezing in elevators gene complex is the one that specifies just the right combination of thresholds and cross-connections among the modules governing humor, reactions to enclosed spaces, sensitivity to the mental states of others, such as their anxiety and boredom, and the sneezing reflux. No one has ever studied heritable variation in language, but I have a strong suspicion of what it is like. I would expect the basic design of language, from X-bar syntax to phonological rules and vocabulary structure, to be uniform across the species. How else could children learn to talk and adults understand one another? But the complexity of language circuitry leaves plenty of scope for quantitative variation to combine into unique linguistic profiles. Some module might be relatively stunted or hypertrophied. Some normally unconscious representation of sound or meaning or grammatical structure might be more accessible to the rest of the brain. Some connection between language circuitry and the intellect or emotions might be faster or slower. Thus, I predict that there are idiosyncratic combinations of genes, detectable and identical twins reared apart, behind the raconteur, the punster, the accidental poet, the sweet talker, the rapier-like wit, the sesquipedalian, the word juggler, the owner of the gift of gab, the Reverend Spooner, the Mrs. Malaprop, the Alexander Haig, the woman and her teenage son I once tested who can talk backwards, and the student at the back of every linguistics classroom who objects that, "Who do you believe the claim that John saw?" doesn't sound so bad. Between 1988 and 1992, many people suspected that the chief executive of the United States and his second-in-command were not playing with a full linguistic deck. I am less interested in what the definition is. You might argue technically that we are in a recession or not, but when there's this kind of sluggishness and concern, definitions, heck with it. I'm all for Lawrence Welk. Lawrence Welk is a wonderful man. He used to be, or was, or wherever he is now, bless him. George Bush. Hawaii has always been a very pivotal role in the Pacific. It is in the Pacific. It is a part of the United States that is an island that is right here. Speaking to the United Negro College Fund, whose motto is, "A mind is a terrible thing to waste," "What a terrible thing to have lost one's mind, or not to have a mind at all. How true that is." Dan Quayle. And who knows what unrepeatable amalgam of genes creates the linguistic genius. If people don't want to come out to the ballpark, nobody's going to stop them. You can observe a lot just by watching. In baseball, you don't know nothing. Nobody goes there anymore. It's too crowded. It ain't over till it's over. It gets late early this time of year. Yogi Berra. And Na is the letter I use to spell nutches, who live in small caves known as niches for hutches. These nutches have troubles, the biggest of which is the fact there are many more nutches than niches. Each nutch in a niche knows that some other nutch would like to move into his niche very much. So each nutch in a niche has to watch that small niche, or nutches who haven't got niches will snitch. Dr. Seuss. Lolita, light of my life, fire of my loins, my sin, my soul. Lolita. The tip of the tongue taking a trip of 3 steps down the palate to tap at 3 on the teeth. Lolita. Vladimir Nabokov. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the people's injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my 4 little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. Martin Luther King, Jr. This goodly frame, the earth, seems to me a sterile promontory. This most excellent canopy, the air, look you, this brave o'erhanging firmament, this majestical roof fretted with golden fire, why, it appears no other thing to me than a foul and pestilent congregation of vapors. What a piece of work is a man! How noble in reason! How infinite in faculty! In form and moving, how express and admirable! In action, how like an angel! In apprehension, how like a god! The beauty of the world, the paragon of animals, and yet, to me, what is this quintessence of dust? William Shakespeare. Chapter 11. The Big Bang. The elephant's trunk is 6 feet long and 1 foot thick and contains 60,000 muscles. Elephants can use their trunks to uproot trees, stack timber, or carefully place huge logs in position when recruited to build bridges. An elephant can curl its trunk around a pencil and draw characters on letter-size paper. With the 2 muscular extensions at the tip, it can remove a thorn, pick up a pin or a dime, uncork a bottle, slide the bolt off a cage door, and hide it on a ledge, or grip a cup so firmly without breaking it that only another elephant can pull it away. The tip is sensitive enough for a blindfolded elephant to ascertain the shape and texture of objects. In the wild, elephants use their trunks to pull up clumps of grass and tap them against their knees to knock off the dirt, to shake coconuts out of palm trees, and to powder their bodies with dust. They use their trunks to probe the ground as they walk, avoiding pit traps, and to dig wells and siphon water from them. Elephants can walk underwater on the beds of deep rivers or swim like submarines for miles using their trunks as snorkels. They communicate through their trunks by trumpeting, humming, roaring, piping, purring, rumbling, and making a crumpling metal sound by rapping the trunk against the ground. The trunk is lined with chemoreceptors that allow the elephant to smell python hidden in the grass or food a mile away. Elephants are the only living animals that possess this extraordinary organ. Their closest living terrestrial relative is the hyrax, a mammal that you would probably not be able to tell from a large guinea pig. Until now, you have probably not given the uniqueness of the elephant's trunk a moment's thought. Certainly, no biologist has made a fuss about it. But now imagine what might happen if some biologists were elephants. Obsessed with the unique place of the trunk in nature, they might ask how it could have evolved, given that no other organism has a trunk or anything like it. One school might try to think up ways to narrow the gap. They would first point out that the elephant and the hyrax share about 90% of their DNA, and thus could not be all that different. They might say that the trunk must not be as complex as everyone thought. Perhaps the number of muscles had been miscounted. They might further note that the hyrax really does have a trunk, but somehow it has been overlooked. After all, the hyrax does have nostrils. Though their attempts to train hyraxes to pick up objects